I didn't marry someone like Adele. My wife, my first wife, was cool and self-contained, unlike the other girls I knew, who were always minimizing themselves, their intelligence, of course, but also their desires and anger and fears and composure. Liesl never did. On our third date, we were walking out of a cafe on McDougal Street, and a man stumbled from a shadowed doorway and vomited on her. Her sweater was chunky with it, that pumpkin bright splatter, and I remember in particular the way a large globule clung to the little diamond ring she wore on her right hand, as if the stone itself had grown a tumor. The people around us gasped or shrieked, but Liesl only closed her eyes. Another woman would have screeched or squealed. I would have screeched or squealed. But I remember she only gave a great shudder, as if her body were acknowledging the disgust, but also removing itself from it. And when she opened her eyes, she was recovered. She peeled off her cardigan, chucked it into the nearest garbage can. "Let's go," she told me. I had been mute, shocked throughout the entire episode. But in that moment, I wanted her, and I followed her where she led me, which turned out to be her apartment, a hellhole on Sullivan Street. The entire time she kept her right hand slightly aloft from her body, the blob of vomit still clinging to her ring. Neither my father nor Adele particularly liked her, although they never told me so. They were polite and respectful of my wishes. In exchange, I never asked them. Never made them lie. I don't think it was because she wasn't Jewish. Neither of my parents were religious. But I think because they thought I was too much in awe of her. Or maybe this is what I've decided late in life. Maybe it was because what I admired as competence, they saw as frigidity or coldness. Goodness knows they wouldn't have been the first to think that. They were always polite to her, and she reasonably so to them, but I think they would have preferred a potential daughter-in-law who would flirt with them a little, to whom they could tell embarrassing stories about my childhood, who would have lunch with Adele and play chess with my father. Someone like you, in fact. But that wasn't Liesl, and wouldn't ever be. And once they realized that, they too remained a bit aloof, not to express their displeasure, but as a sort of self-discipline, a reminder to themselves that there were limits. Her limits, that they should try to respect. When I was with her, I felt oddly relaxed, as if, in the face of such sturdy competence, even misfortune wouldn't dare try to challenge us. We had met in New York, where I was in law school and she was in medical school, and after graduating, I got a clerkship in Boston, and she, 1 year older than I, started her internship. She was training to be an oncologist. I had been admiring of that, of course, because of what it suggested. There is nothing more soothing than a woman who wants to heal, whom you imagine bent maternally over a patient, her lab coat white as clouds. But Liesl didn't want to be admired. She was interested in oncology because it was one of the harder disciplines, because it was thought to be more cerebral. She and her fellow oncological interns had scorn for the radiologists, too mercenary. The cardiologists, too puffed up and pleased with themselves, the pediatricians, too sentimental, and especially the surgeons, unspeakably arrogant, and the dermatologists, beneath comment, although they, of course, worked with them frequently. They liked the anesthesiologists, weird and geeky and fastidious and prone to addiction, the pathologists, even more cerebral than they, and, well, that was about it. Sometimes a group of them would come over to our house and would linger after dinner discussing cases and studies while their partners, lawyers and historians and writers and lesser scientists, were ignored until we slunk off to the living room to discuss the various trivial, less interesting things with which we occupied our days. We were two adults, and it was a happy enough life. There was no whining that we didn't spend enough time with each other, from me or from her. We remained in Boston for her residency, and then she moved back to New York to do her fellowship. I stayed. By that time, I was working at a firm and was an adjunct at the law school. We saw each other on the weekends, one in Boston, one in New York. And then she completed her program and returned to Boston. We married. We bought a house, a little one, not the one I have now, just at the edge of Cambridge. My father and Adele, and Liesl's parents for that matter, mysteriously they were considerably more emotive than she was, and on our infrequent trips to Santa Barbara, while her father made jokes and her mother placed before me plates of sliced cucumbers and peppered tomatoes from her garden, she would watch with a closed-off expression, as if embarrassed or at least perplexed by their relative expansiveness. Never asked us if we were going to have children. I think they thought that as long as they didn't ask, there was a chance we might. The truth was that I didn't really feel the need for it. I had never envisioned having a child. I didn't feel about them one way or the other. And that seemed enough of a reason not to. Having a child, I thought, was something you should actively want, crave even. It was not a venture for the ambivalent or passionless. Liesl felt the same way, or so we thought. But then, one evening, I was 31, she was 32, young, I came home and she was already in the kitchen, waiting for me. This was unusual. She worked longer hours than I did, and I usually didn't see her until 8 or 9 at night. "I need to talk to you," she said, solemnly. And I was suddenly scared. She saw that and smiled. She wasn't a cruel person, Liesl, and I don't mean to give the impression that she was without kindness, without gentleness, because she had both in her, was capable of both. "It's nothing bad, Harold." Then she laughed a little. "I don't think." I sat. She inhaled. "I'm pregnant. I don't know how it happened. I must have skipped a pill or two and forgotten. It's almost 8 weeks. I had it confirmed at Sally's today." Sally was her roommate from their med school days, her best friend and her gynecologist. She said all this very quickly, in staccato, digestible sentences. Then she was silent. "I'm on a pill where I don't get my periods, you know, so I didn't know. And then, when I said nothing, say something." I couldn't at first. "How do you feel?" I asked. She shrugged. "I feel fine." "Good," I said stupidly. "Harold," she said, and sat across from me. "What do you want to do?" "What do you want to do?" She shrugged again. "I know what I want to do. I want to know what you want to do. You don't want to keep it." She didn't disagree. "I want to hear what you want." "What if I say I want to keep it?" She was ready. "Then I'd seriously consider it." I hadn't been expecting this either. "Lise," I said, "we should do what you want to do." This wasn't completely magnanimous. It was mostly cowardly. In this case, as with many things, I was happy to cede the decision to her. She sighed. "We don't have to decide tonight. We have some time." 4 weeks, she didn't need to say. In bed, I thought. I thought those thoughts all men think when a woman tells them she's pregnant. What would the baby look like? Would I like it? Would I love it? And then, more crushingly, fatherhood, with all its responsibilities and fulfillments and tedium and possibilities for failure. The next morning we didn't speak of it, and the day after that we didn't speak of it again. On Friday, as we were going to bed, she said, sleepily, "Tomorrow we've got to discuss this." And I said, "Absolutely." But we didn't, and we didn't. And then the 9th week passed, and then the 10th, and then the 11th and 12th, and then it was too late to easily or ethically do anything, and I think we were both relieved. The decision had been made for us, or rather our indecisiveness had made the decision for us, and we were going to have a child. It was the first time in our marriage that we'd been so mutually indecisive. We had imagined that it would be a girl, and if it was, we'd name it Adele for my mother and Sarah for Sally. But it wasn't a girl, and we instead let Adele, who was so happy she started crying, one of the very few times I'd seen her cry, pick the first name and Sally the second. Jacob Moore. Why Moore? We asked Sally, who said it was for Thomas Moore. I have never been one of those people, I know you aren't either, who feels that the love one has for a child is somehow a superior love, one more meaningful, more significant, and grander than any other. I didn't feel that before Jacob, and I didn't feel that after. But it is a singular love, because it is a love whose foundation is not physical attraction, or pleasure, or intellect, but fear. You have never known fear until you have a child, and maybe that is what tricks us into thinking that it is more magnificent, because the fear itself is more magnificent. Every day your first thought is not, I love him, but how is he? The world, overnight, rearranges itself into an obstacle course of terrors. I would hold him in my arms and wait to cross the street, and would think how absurd it was that my child, that any child, could expect to survive this life. It seemed as improbable as the survival of one of those late spring butterflies, you know, those little white ones I sometimes saw wobbling through the air, always just millimeters away from smacking itself against a windshield. And let me tell you two other things I learned. The first is that it doesn't matter how old that child is, or when, or how he became yours. Once you decide to think of someone as your child, something changes, and everything you have previously enjoyed about them, everything you have previously felt for them, is preceded first by that fear. It's not biological. It's something extra-biological, less a determination to ensure the survival of one's genetic code, and more a desire to prove oneself inviolable to the universe's feints and challenges, to triumph over the things that want to destroy what's yours. The second thing is this. When your child dies, you feel everything you'd expect to feel, feeling so well documented by so many others that I won't even bother to list them here, except to say that everything that's written about mourning is all the same, and it's all the same for a reason, because there is no real deviation from the text. Sometimes you feel more of one thing and less of another, and sometimes you feel them out of order, and sometimes you feel them for a longer time or a shorter time. But the sensations are always the same. But here's what no one says. When it's your child, a part of you, a very tiny but nonetheless unignorable part of you, also feels relief. Because finally, the moment you have been expecting, been dreading, been preparing yourself for since the day you became a parent, has come. Ah, you tell yourself, it's arrived. Here it is. And after that, you have nothing to fear again. Years ago, after the publication of my third book, a journalist once asked me if you could tell right away whether a student had a mind for law or not. And the answer is, sometimes. But often, you're wrong. The student who seems so bright in the first half of the semester becomes steadily less so as the year goes on, and the student about whom you never thought one thing or another is the one who emerges as a dazzler, someone you love hearing think. It's often the most naturally intelligent students who have the most difficult time in their first year. Law school, particularly the first year of law school, is really not a place where creativity, abstract thought, and imagination are rewarded. In this way, I often think, based upon what I've heard, not what I know firsthand, that it's a bit like art school. Julia had a friend, a man named Dennis, who was, as a boy, a tremendously gifted artist. They had been friends since they were small, and she once showed me some of the drawings he made when he was 10 or 12, little sketches of birds pecking at the ground, of his face, round and blank, of his father, the local veterinarian, his hand smoothing the fur of a grimacing terrier. Dennis's father didn't see the point of drawing lessons, however, and so he was never formally schooled. But when they were older and Julia went to university, Dennis went to art school to learn how to draw. For the first week, he said, they were allowed to draw whatever they wanted, and it was always Dennis's sketches that the professor selected to pin up on the wall for praise and critique. But then they were made to learn how to draw, to redraw, in essence. Week two, they only drew ellipses, wide ellipses, fat ellipses, skinny ellipses. Week three, they drew circles, three-dimensional circles, two-dimensional circles. Then it was a flower, then a vase, then a hand, then a head, then a body. And with each week of proper training, Dennis got worse and worse. By the time the term had ended, his pictures were never displayed on the wall. He had grown too self-conscious to draw. When he saw a dog now, its long fur whisking the ground beneath it, he saw not a dog, but a circle on a box. And when he tried to draw it, he worried about proportion, not about recording its dogginess. He decided to speak to his professor. "We are meant to break you down, Dennis," his professor said. "Only the truly talented will be able to come back from it." "I guess I wasn't one of the truly talented," Dennis would say. He became a barrister instead, lived in London with his partner. "Poor Dennis," Julia would say. "Oh, it's all right," Dennis would sigh, but none of us were convinced. And in that same way, law school breaks a mind down. Novelists, poets, and artists don't often do well in law school, unless they are bad novelists, poets, and artists, but neither necessarily do mathematicians, logicians, and scientists. The first group fails because their logic is their own. The second fails because logic is all they own. He, however, was a good student, a great student, from the beginning. But this greatness was often camouflaged in an aggressive non-greatness. I knew from listening to his answers in class that he had everything he needed to be a superb lawyer. It's not accidental that law is called a trade, and like all trades, what it demands most is a capacious memory, which he had. What it demands next, again like many trades, is the ability to see the problem before you, and then, just as immediately, the rat's tail of problems that might follow. Much of the way that, for a contractor, a house is not just a structure. It's a snarl of pipes engorging with ice in the winter, of shingles swelling with humidity in the summer, of rain gutters belching up fountains of water in the spring, of cement splitting in the first autumn cold. So, too, is a house something else for a lawyer. A house is a locked safe full of contracts, of liens, of future lawsuits, of possible violations. It represents potential attacks on your property, on your goods, on your person, on your privacy. Of course, you can't literally think like this all the time, or you'd drive yourself crazy. And so for most lawyers, a house is, finally, just a house, something to fill and fix and repaint and empty. But there's a period in which every law student, every good law student, finds that their vision shifts somehow and realizes that the law is inescapable, that no interaction, no aspect of daily life escapes its long, graspy fingers. A street becomes a shocking disaster, a riot of violations and potential civil lawsuits. A marriage looks like a divorce. The world becomes temporarily unbearable. He could do this. He could take a case and see its end. It is very difficult to do because you have to be able to hold in your head all the possibilities, all the probable consequences, and then choose which ones to worry over and which to ignore. But what he also did, what he couldn't stop himself from doing, was wonder as well about the moral implications of the case. And that is not helpful in law school. There were colleagues of mine who wouldn't let their students even say the words right and wrong. "Right has nothing to do with it," one of my professors used to bellow at us. "What is the law? What does the law say?" Law professors enjoy being theatrical. All of us do. Another, whenever the words were mentioned, would say nothing, but walk over to the offender and hand him a little slip of paper, a stack of which he kept in his jacket's inside pocket, that read, Draymond 241. Draymond 241 was the philosophy department's office. Here, for example, is a hypothetical. A football team is going to an away game when one of their vans breaks down. So they ask the mother of one of the players if they can borrow her van to transport them. Sure, she says, but I'm not going to drive. And so she asks the assistant coach to drive the team for her. But then, as they're driving along, something horrible happens. The van skids off the road and flips over. Everyone inside dies. There is no criminal case here. The road was slippery, the driver wasn't intoxicated. It was an accident. But then the parents of the team, the mothers and fathers of the dead players, sue the owner of the van. It was her van, they argue, but more important, it was she who appointed the driver of her van. He was only her agent, and therefore it is she who bears the responsibility. So, what happens? Should the plaintiffs win their suit? Students don't like this case. I don't teach it that often. Its extremity makes it more flashy than it is instructive, I believe. But whenever I did, I would always hear a voice in the auditorium say, "But it's not fair." And as annoying as that word is, fair, it is important that students never forget the concept. Fair is never an answer, I would tell them. But it is always a consideration. He never mentioned whether something was fair, however. Fairness itself seemed to hold little interest for him, which I found fascinating, as people, especially young people, are very interested in what's fair. Fairness is a concept taught to nice children. It is the governing principle of kindergartens and summer camps and playgrounds and soccer fields. Jacob, back when he was able to go to school and learn things and think and speak, knew what fairness was and that it was important, something to be valued. Fairness is for happy people. For people who have been lucky enough to have lived a life defined more by certainties than by ambiguities. Right and wrong, however, are for, well, not unhappy people, maybe, but scarred people, scared people. Or am I just thinking this now? So were the plaintiffs successful? I asked. That year, his first year, I had in fact taught that case. Yes, he said, and he explained why. He knew instinctively why they would have been. And then, right on cue, I heard the tiny, "But it's not fair," from the back of the room, and before I could begin my first lecture of the season, "Fair is never an answer, etc., etc.," he said quietly, "But it's right." I was never able to ask him what he meant by that. Class ended, and everyone got up at once and almost ran for the door, as if the room was on fire. I remember telling myself to ask him about it in the next class, later that week, but I forgot. And then I forgot again and again. Over the years, I would remember this conversation every now and again, and each time I would think, I must ask him what he meant by that. But then I never would. I don't know why. And so this became his pattern. He knew the law. He had a feeling for it. But then, just when I wanted him to stop talking, he would introduce a moral argument. He would mention ethics. "Please," I would think, "please don't do this. The law is simple. It allows for less nuance than you'd imagine. Ethics and morals do, in reality, have a place in law, although not in jurisprudence. It is morals that help us make the laws, but morals do not help us apply them." I was worried he'd make it harder for himself, that he'd complicate the real gift he had with, as much as I hate to have to say this about my profession, thinking. "Stop," I wanted to tell him, but I never did, because eventually I realized I enjoyed hearing him think. In the end, of course, I needn't have worried. He learned how to control it. He learned to stop mentioning right and wrong. And as we know, this tendency of his didn't stop him from becoming a great lawyer. But later, often, I was sad for him. and for me. I wished I had urged him to leave law school. I wished I had told him to go to the equivalent of Draymond 241. The skills I gave him were not the skills he needed after all. I wish I had nudged him in a direction where his mind could have been as supple as it was, where he wouldn't have to harness himself to a dull way of thinking. I felt I had taken someone who once knew how to draw a dog and turned him into someone who instead knew only how to draw shapes. I am guilty of many things when it comes to him, but sometimes, illogically, I feel guiltiest for this. I opened the van door. I invited him inside. And while I didn't drive off the road, I instead drove him somewhere bleak and cold and colorless and left him standing there, where, back where I had collected him, the landscape shimmered with color, the sky fizzed with fireworks, and he stood open-mouthed in wonder. Chapter 3 3 weeks before he left for Thanksgiving in Boston, a package, a large, flat, unwieldy wooden crate with his name and address written on every side in black marker, arrived for him at work, where it sat by his desk all day until he was able to open it late that night. From the return address, he knew what it was, but he still felt that reflexive curiosity one does when unwrapping anything, even something unwanted. Inside the box were layers of brown paper, and then layers of bubble wrap, and then, wrapped in sheets of white paper, the painting itself. He turned it over. To Jude, with love and apologies, J.B. J.B. had scribbled on the canvas, directly above his signature, Jean-Baptiste Marion. There was an envelope from J.B.'s gallery taped to the back of the frame, inside of which was a letter certifying the painting's authenticity and date, addressed to him and signed by the gallery's registrar. He called Willem, who he knew would have already left the theater and was probably on his way home. "Guess what I got today?" There was only the slightest of pauses before Willem answered, "The painting." "Right," he said, and sighed. "So I suppose you're behind this?" Willem coughed. "I just told him he didn't have a choice in the matter any longer. Not if he wanted you to talk to him again at some point." Willem paused, and he could hear the wind whooshing past him. "Do you need help getting it home?" "Thanks," he said, "but I'm just going to leave it here for now and pick it up later." He reclad the painting in its layers and replaced it in its box, which he shoved beneath his console. Before he shut off his computer, he began a note to J.B., then stopped and deleted what he'd written, and instead left for the night. He was both surprised and not that J.B. had sent him the painting after all, and not at all surprised to learn that it had been Willem who had convinced him to do so. 18 months ago, just as Willem was beginning his first performances in the Malamud Theorem, J.B. had been offered representation by a gallery on the Lower East Side, and the previous spring, he'd had his first solo show, The Boys, a series of 24 paintings based on photographs he'd taken of the three of them. As he'd promised years ago, J.B. had let him see the pictures of him that he wanted to paint, and although he had approved many of them, reluctantly, he had felt queasy even as he did so, but he knew how important the series was to J.B. J.B. had ultimately been less interested in the ones he'd approved than in the ones he wouldn't, a few of which, including an image in which he was curled into himself in bed, his eyes open but scarily unseeing, his left hand stretched open unnaturally wide, like a ghoul's claw, he alarmingly had no memory of J.B. even taking. That had been the first fight, J.B. wheedling, then sulking, then threatening, then shouting, and then, when he couldn't change his mind, trying to convince Willem to advocate for him. "You realize I don't actually owe you anything," J.B. had told him once he realized his negotiations with Willem weren't progressing. "I mean, I don't technically have to ask your permission here. I could technically just paint whatever the fuck I want. This is a courtesy I'm extending you, you know." He could have swamped J.B. with arguments, but he was too angry to do so. "You promised me, J.B.," he said. "That should be enough." He could have added, "And you owe me as my friend." But he had a few years ago come to realize that J.B.'s definition of friendship and its responsibilities was different than his own, and there was no arguing with him about it. You either accepted it or you didn't, and he had decided to accept it, although recently the work it took to accept J.B. and his limitations had begun to feel more enraging and wearisome and arduous than seemed necessary. In the end, J.B. had had to admit defeat, although in the months before his show opened, he had made occasional allusions to what he called his lost paintings, great works he could have made had he, Jude, been less rigid, less timid, less self-conscious, and, this was his favorite of J.B.'s arguments, less of a Philistine. Later, though, he would be embarrassed by his own gullibility, by how he had trusted that his wishes would be respected. The opening had been on a Thursday in late April, shortly after his 30th birthday, a night so unseasonably cold that the plane tree's first leaves had frozen and cracked, and rounding the corner onto Norfolk Street, he had stopped to admire the scene the gallery made, a bright, golden box of light and shimmered warmth against the chilled, flat black of the night. Inside, he immediately encountered Black Henry Young and a friend of theirs from law school, and then so many other people he knew, from college and their various parties at Lispenard Street, and J.B.'s aunts and Malcolm's parents, and long-ago friends of J.B.'s that he hadn't seen in years, that it had taken some time before he could push through the crowd to look at the paintings themselves. He had always known that J.B. was talented. They all did. Everyone did. No matter how ungenerously you might occasionally think of J.B. as a person, there was something about his work that could convince you that you were wrong, that whatever deficiencies of character you had ascribed to him were in reality evidence of your own pettiness and ill temper, that hidden within J.B. was someone of huge sympathies and depth and understanding. And that night, he had no trouble at all recognizing the painting's intensity and beauty, and he had felt only an uncomplicated pride in and gratitude for J.B., for the accomplishment of the work, of course, but also for his ability to produce colors and images that made all other colors and images seem wan and flaccid in comparison, for his ability to make you see the world anew. The paintings had been arranged in a single row that unspooled across the walls like a stave, and the tones J.B. had created, dense, bruised blues and bourbonish yellows, were so distinctly their own, it was as if J.B. had invented a different language of color altogether. He stopped to admire Willem and the girl, one of the pictures he had already seen and had indeed already bought, in which J.B. had painted Willem turned away from the camera, but for his eyes, which seemed to look directly back at the viewer, but were actually looking at, presumably, a girl who had been standing in Willem's exact sightline. He loved the expression on Willem's face, which was one he knew very well. When he was just about to smile, and his mouth was still soft and undecided somehow, but the muscles around his eyes were already pulling themselves upward. The paintings weren't arranged chronologically, and so after this was one of himself from just a few months ago. He hurried past the ones of himself, and following that an image of Malcolm and his sister, in what he recognized from the furniture was Flora's long-departed first West Village apartment, Malcolm and Flora, Bethune Street. He looked around for J.B. and saw him talking to the gallery director, and at that moment J.B. straightened his neck and caught his eye and gave him a wave. "Genius," he mouthed to J.B. over people's heads, and J.B. grinned at him and mouthed back, "Thank you." But then he had moved to the third and final wall and had seen them. Two paintings, both of him, neither of which J.B. had ever shown him. In the first, he was very young and holding a cigarette, and in the second, which he thought was from around 2 years ago, He was sitting bent over on the edge of his bed, leaning his forehead against the wall, his legs and arms crossed and his eyes closed. It was the position he always assumed when he was coming out of an episode, and was gathering his physical resources before attempting to stand up again. He hadn't remembered J.B. taking this picture, and indeed, given its perspective, the camera peeking around the edge of the doorframe, he knew that he wasn't meant to remember, because he wasn't meant to be aware of the picture's existence at all. For a moment, the noise of the space blotted out around him, and he could only look and look at the paintings. Even in his distress, he had the presence of mind to understand that he was responding less to the images themselves than to the memories and sensations they provoked, and that his sense of violation that other people should be seeing these documentations of two miserable moments of his life was a personal reaction, specific only to himself. To anyone else, they would be two contextless paintings, meaningless unless he chose to announce their meaning. But oh, they were difficult for him to see, and he wished, suddenly and sharply, that he was alone. He made it through the post-opening dinner, which was endless and at which he missed Willem intensely, but Willem had a show that night and hadn't been able to come. At least he hadn't had to speak to J.B. at all, who was busy holding court, and to the people who approached him, including J.B.'s gallerist, to tell him that the final two pictures, the ones of him, were the best in the show, as if he were somehow responsible for this. He was able to smile and agree with them that J.B. was an extraordinary talent. But later, at home after regaining control of himself, he was at last free to articulate to Willem his sense of betrayal. And Willem had taken his side so unhesitatingly, had been so angry on his behalf that he had been momentarily soothed, and had realized that J.B.'s duplicity had come as a surprise to Willem as well. This had begun the second fight, which had started with a confrontation with J.B. at a cafe near J.B.'s apartment, during which J.B. had proven maddeningly incapable of apologizing. Instead, he talked and talked about how wonderful the pictures were, and how someday, once he had gotten over whatever issues he had with himself, he'd come to appreciate them, and how it wasn't even that big a deal, and how he really needed to confront his insecurities, which were groundless anyway, and maybe this would prove helpful in that process, and how everyone except him knew how incredibly great-looking he was, and so shouldn't that tell him something? That maybe, no, definitely, he was the one who was wrong about himself? And finally, how the pictures were already done. They were finished. And what did he expect should happen? Would he be happier if they were destroyed? Should he rip them off the wall and set them on fire? They had been seen and couldn't be unseen. So why couldn't he just accept it and get over it? "I'm not asking you to destroy them, J.B.," he'd said, so furious and dizzied by J.B.'s bizarre logic and almost offensive intractability that he wanted to scream. "I'm asking you to apologize." But J.B. couldn't, or wouldn't. And finally he had gotten up and left, and J.B. hadn't tried to stop him. After that, he simply stopped speaking to J.B. Willem had made his own approach, and the two of them, as Willem told him, had actually begun shouting at each other in the street, and then Willem, too, had stopped speaking to J.B., and so from then on, they had to rely primarily on Malcolm for news of J.B. Malcolm, typically non-committal, had admitted to them that he thought J.B. was totally in the wrong, while at the same time suggesting that they were both being unrealistic. "You know he's not going to apologize, Judy," he said. "This is J.B. we're talking about. You're wasting your time." "Am I being unreasonable?" he asked Willem after this conversation. "No," Willem said immediately. "It's fucked up, Jude. He fucked up and he needs to apologize." The show sold out. Willem and the girl was delivered to him at work, as was Willem and Jude, Lispenard Street 2, which Willem had bought. Jude, after sickness, the title when he learned it, had made him so newly angry and humiliated that for a moment he experienced what the saying, blind with rage, meant, was sold to a collector whose purchases were considered benedictions and predictive of future success. He only bought from artists' debut shows, and almost every artist whose work he had bought had gone on to have a major career. Only the show's centerpiece, Jude with Cigarette, remained unplaced, and this was due to a shockingly amateurish error in which the director of the gallery had sold it to an important British collector, and the owner of the gallery had sold it to the Museum of Modern Art. "So perfect," Willem said to Malcolm, knowing Malcolm would ferry his words back to J.B. "J.B. should tell the gallery that he's keeping the painting, and he should just give it to Jude." "He can't do that," Malcolm said, as appalled as if Willem had suggested simply tossing the canvas into a trash can. "It's MoMA." "Who cares?" Willem asked. "If he's that fucking good, he'll have another shot at MoMA. But I'm telling you, Malcolm, this is really the only solution he has left if he wants to keep Jude as a friend." He paused. "And me too." So Malcolm conveyed that message, and the prospect of losing Willem as a friend had been enough to make J.B. call Willem and demand a meeting, at which J.B. had cried and accused Willem of betraying him and always taking Jude's side and obviously not giving a shit about his, J.B.'s, career when he, J.B., had always supported Willem's. All of this had taken place over months, as spring had turned into summer, and he and Willem had gone to Truro without J.B. and without Malcolm, who told them he was afraid of leaving J.B. on his own, and J.B. had gone to the Irvines in Aquinnah over Memorial Day, and they had gone over the 4th of July, and he and Willem had taken the long-planned trip to Croatia and Turkey by themselves. And then it was fall, and by the time Willem and J.B. had their second meeting, Willem had suddenly and unexpectedly booked his first film role, playing the king in an adaptation of The Girl with the Silver Hands, and was leaving to shoot in Sofia in January, and he had gotten a promotion at work and had been approached by a partner at Cromwell Thurman Grayson and Ross, one of the best corporate firms in the city, and was having to use the wheelchair Andy had gotten him that May more often than not, and Willem had broken up with his girlfriend of a year, and was dating a costume designer named Philippa, and his former fellow law clerk Kerrigan had written a mass email to everyone he had ever worked with, in which he simultaneously came out and denounced conservatism, and Harold had been asking him who was coming over for Thanksgiving this year, and if he could stay a night after whoever he invited had left, because he and Julia needed to talk about something with him, and he had seen plays with Malcolm and gallery shows with Willem, and had read novels that he would have argued about with J.B., as the two of them were the novel readers of the group. A whole list of things the four of them would have once picked over together, that they now instead discussed in twos or threes. At first it had been disorienting, after so many years of operating as a foursome, but he had gotten used to it, and although he missed J.B., his witty self-involvement, the way he could see everything the world had to offer only as it might affect him, he also found himself unable to forgive him, and, simultaneously, able to see his life without him. And now, he supposed, their fight was over, and the painting was his. Willem came down with him to the office that Saturday, and he unwrapped it and leaned it against the wall, and the two of them regarded it in silence, as if it were a rare and inert zoo animal. This was the painting that had been reproduced in the Times Review, and later, the Art Forum story, but it wasn't until now, in the safety of his office, that he was able to truly appreciate it. If he could forget it was him, he could almost see how lovely an image it was, and why J.B. would have been attracted to it. For the strange person in it who looked so frightened and watchful, who was discernibly neither female nor male, whose clothes looked borrowed, who was mimicking the gestures and postures of adulthood while clearly understanding nothing of them. He no longer felt anything for that person. But not feeling anything for that person had been a conscious act of will, like turning away from someone in the street even though you saw them constantly, and pretending you couldn't see them day after day until one day you actually couldn't. Or so you could make yourself believe. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, he admitted to Willem, regretfully because he didn't want the painting, and yet felt guilty that Willem had axed J.B. out of his life on his behalf, and for something he knew he would never look at again. Well, said Willem, and there was a silence. You could always give it to Harold. I'm sure he'd love it. And he knew then that Willem had perhaps always known that he didn't want the painting, and that it hadn't mattered to him, that he hadn't regretted choosing him over J.B., that he didn't blame him for having to make that decision. I could, he said slowly, although he knew he wouldn't. Harold would indeed love it. He had when he had seen the show, and would hang it somewhere prominent, and whenever he went to visit him, he would have to look at it. I'm sorry, Willem, he said at last. I'm sorry to drag you down here. I think I'll leave it here until I figure out what to do. It's okay, Willem said, and the two of them wrapped it up again and replaced it under his desk. After Willem left, he turned on his phone, and this time he did write J.B. a message. J.B., he began, thanks very much for the painting and for your apology, both of which mean a lot. He paused, thinking about what to say next. I've missed you and want to hear what's been going on in your life, he continued. Call me when you have some time to hang out. It was all true. And suddenly, he knew what he should do with the painting. He looked up the address for J.B.'s registrar and wrote her a note, thanking her for sending him Jude with cigarette and telling her that he wanted to donate it to MoMA, and could she help facilitate the transaction. Later, he would look back on this episode as a sort of fulcrum, the hinge between a relationship that was one thing and then became something else. His friendship with J.B., of course, but also his friendship with Willem. There had been periods in his 20s when he would look at his friends and feel such a pure, deep contentment that he would wish the world around them would simply cease, that none of them would have to move from that moment, when everything was in equilibrium and his affection for them was perfect. But of course, that was never to be. A beat later and everything shifted, and the moment quietly vanished. It would have been too melodramatic, too final to say that after this, J.B. was forever diminished for him. But it was true that for the first time, he was able to comprehend that the people he had grown to trust might someday betray him anyway, and that as disappointing as it might be, it was inevitable as well, and that life would keep propelling him steadily forward, because for everyone who might fail him in some way, there was at least one person who never would. It was his opinion, shared by Julia, that Harold had a tendency to make Thanksgiving more complicated than it needed to be. Every year since he'd first been invited to Harold and Julia's for the holiday, Harold promised him, usually in early November, when he was still full of enthusiasm for the project, that this year he was going to blow his mind by upending the lamest of American culinary traditions. Harold always began with big ambitions. Their first Thanksgiving together, 9 years ago, when he was in his second year of law school, Harold had announced he was going to make duck à l'orange, with kumquats standing in for the oranges. But when he arrived at Harold's house with the walnut cake he'd baked the night before, Julia was standing alone in the doorway to greet him. "Don't mention the duck," she whispered as she kissed him hello. In the kitchen, a harassed-looking Harold was lifting a large turkey out of the oven. "Don't say a word," Harold warned him. "What would I say?" he asked. This year, Harold asked how he felt about trout. "Trout stuffed with other stuff," he added. "I like trout," he'd answered cautiously. "But you know, Harold, I actually like turkey." They had a variation on this conversation every year, with Harold proposing various animals and proteins, steamed black-footed Chinese chicken, filet mignon, tofu with wood ear fungus, smoked whitefish salad on homemade rye, as turkey improvements. No one likes turkey, Jude, Harold said impatiently. I know what you're doing. Don't insult me by pretending you do because you don't think I'm actually capable of making anything else. We're having trout, and that's it. Also, can you make that cake you made last year? I think it'd go well with this wine I got. Just send me a list of what you need me to get. The perplexing thing, he always thought, was that, in general, Harold wasn't that interested in food or wine. In fact, he had terrible taste and was often taking him to restaurants that were overpriced yet mediocre, where Harold would happily devour dull plates of blackened meat and unimaginative sides of gloppy pasta. He and Julia, who also had little interest in food, discussed Harold's strange fixation every year. Harold had numerous obsessions, some of them inexplicable, but this one seemed particularly so, and more so for its endurance. Willem thought that Harold's Thanksgiving quest had begun partly as shtick, but over the years it had morphed into something more serious, and now he was truly unable to stop himself, even as he knew he'd never succeed. But you know, Willem said, it's really all about you. What do you mean? He'd asked. It's a performance for you, Willem had said. It's his way of telling you he cares about you enough to try to impress you, without actually saying he cares about you. He'd dismissed this right away. I don't think so, Willem. But sometimes he pretended to himself that Willem might be right, feeling silly and a little pathetic because of how happy the thought made him. Willem was the only one coming to Thanksgiving this year. By the time he and J.B. had reconciled, J.B. had already made plans to go to his aunt's with Malcolm. When he tried to cancel, they had apparently been so irked that he decided not to antagonize them further. "What's it going to be this year?" asked Willem. They were taking the train up on Wednesday, the night before Thanksgiving. "Elk? Venison? Turtle?" "Trout," he said. "Trout," Willem replied. "Well, trout's easy. We may actually end up with trout this year." He said he was going to stuff it with something, though. "Oh, I take it back." There were eight of them at dinner. Harold and Julia, Lawrence and Jillian, Julia's friend James and his boyfriend Carrie, and he and Willem. "This is dynamite trout, Harold," Willem said, cutting into his second piece of turkey, and everyone laughed. What was the point, he wondered, at which he had stopped feeling so nervous and out of place at Harold's dinners? Certainly his friends had helped. Harold liked sparring with them, liked trying to provoke J.B. into making outrageous and borderline racist statements, liked teasing Willem about when he was going to settle down, liked debating structural and aesthetic trends with Malcolm. He knew Harold enjoyed engaging with them, and that they enjoyed it too. And it gave him the chance to simply listen to them being who they were without feeling the need to participate. They were a fleet of parrots shaking their bright-colored feathers at one another, presenting themselves to their peers without fear or guile. The dinner was dominated by talk of James's daughter, who was getting married in the summer. "I'm an old man," James moaned. And Lawrence and Jillian, whose daughters were still in college and spending the holiday at their friend's house in Carmel, made sympathetic noises. "This reminds me," said Harold, looking at him and Willem. "When are you two ever going to settle down?"
"I think he means you," he smiled at Willem.
"Harold, I'm 32, Willem protested. And everyone laughed again as Harold spluttered, "What is that, Willem? Is that an explanation? Is that a defense? It's not like you're 16. But as much as he enjoyed the evening, a part of his mind remained abuzz and anxious, worrying about the conversation Harold and Julia wanted to have with him the next day. He had finally mentioned it to Willem on the ride up, and in moments, when the two of them were working together, stuffing the turkey, blanching the potatoes, setting the table, they would try to figure out what Harold might have to say to him. After dinner, they put on their coats and sat in the back garden, puzzling over it again. At least he knew that nothing was wrong with them.
It was the first thing he had asked, and Harold had assured him that he and Julia were both fine. But what, then, could it be? Maybe he thinks I'm hanging around them too much, he suggested to Willem. Maybe Harold was simply sick of him. Not possible, Willem said, so quickly and declaratively that he was relieved. They were quiet. Maybe one of them got a job offer somewhere and they're moving? I thought of that too, but I don't think Harold would ever leave Boston. Julia either. There weren't, in the end, many options, at least many that would make a conversation with him necessary. Maybe they were selling the house in Truro, but why would they need to talk to him about that, as much as he loved the house? Maybe Harold and Julia were splitting up, but they seemed the same as they always did around each other. Maybe they were selling the New York apartment and wanted to know if he wanted to buy it from them. Unlikely. He was certain they would never sell the apartment. Maybe they were renovating the apartment and needed him to oversee the renovation. And then their speculations grew more specific and improbable. Maybe Julia was coming out. Maybe Harold was. Maybe Harold was being born again. Maybe Julia was. Maybe they were quitting their jobs, moving to an ashram in upstate New York. Maybe they were becoming ascetics who would live in a remote Kashmiri valley. Maybe they were having his and hers plastic surgery. Maybe Harold was becoming a Republican. Maybe Julia had found God. Maybe Harold had been nominated to be the Attorney General. Maybe Julia had been identified by the Tibetan government in exile as the next reincarnation of the Panchen Lama and was moving to Dharamsala. Maybe Harold was running for president as a socialist candidate. Maybe they were opening a restaurant on the square that served only turkey stuffed with other kinds of meat. By this time, they were both laughing so hard, as much from the nervous, self-soothing helplessness of not knowing as from the absurdity of their guesses, that they were bent over in their chairs, pressing their coat collars to their mouths to muffle the noise, their tears freezing pinchingly on their cheeks. In bed, though, he returned to the thought that had crept tendril-like from some dark space of his mind and had insinuated itself into his consciousness like a thin green vine. Maybe one of them had discovered something about the person he once was. Maybe he would be presented with evidence, a doctor's report, a photograph. This was the nightmare scenario. Film still. He had already decided he wouldn't deny it. He wouldn't argue against it. He wouldn't defend himself. He would acknowledge its veracity. He would apologize. He would explain that he never meant to deceive them. He would offer not to contact them again. And then he would leave. He would ask them only to keep his secret, to not tell anyone else. He practiced saying the words, I'm so sorry, Harold. I'm so sorry, Julia. I never meant to embarrass you. But of course it was such a useless apology. He might not have meant to, but it wouldn't make a difference. He would have. He had. Willem left the next morning. He had a show that night. Call me as soon as you know, okay? He asked, and he nodded. It's going to be fine, Jude, he promised. Whatever it is, we'll figure it out. Don't worry, all right? You know I will anyway, he said, and tried to smile back at Willem. Yeah, I know, said Willem. But try, and call me. The rest of the day he kept himself busy cleaning. There was always plenty to clean at the house, as both Harold and Julia were unenthusiastic tidiers, and by the time they sat down to an early dinner he'd made of turkey stew and a beet salad, he felt almost aloft from nervousness and could only pretend to eat, moving the food around his plate like a compass point, hoping Harold and Julia wouldn't notice. After, he began stacking the plates to take them to the kitchen, but Harold stopped him. Leave them, Jude, he said. Maybe we should have our talk now? He felt himself go fluttery with panic. I should really rinse them off, or everything's going to congeal, he protested, lamely, hearing how stupid he sounded. Fuck the plates, said Harold, and although he knew that Harold genuinely didn't care what did or didn't congeal on his plates, For a moment, he wondered if his casualness was too casual, a simulacrum of ease rather than the real thing. But finally, he could do nothing but put the dishes down and trudge after Harold into the living room, where Julia was pouring coffee.